Fawa's University Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Just 6 weeks before voters go to the polls, the two major U.S. party presidential nominees clashed late Monday in a televised debate at New York's Hofstra University. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton sparred over the economy, race relations, and foreign policy. Trump, the Republican nominee, blamed Clinton for the rise of the Islamic State.
This is something that never should have happened. It should have never happened. Now, you're talking about taking out ISIS, but you were there and you were Secretary of State when it was a little infant. Now it's in over 30 countries.
The former Secretary of State defended the Obama administration's Iranian nuclear deal.
So I spent a year and a half putting together a coalition that included Russia and China to impose the toughest sanctions on Iran. And we did drive them to the negotiating table.
They disagreed over economic and tax policy. Clinton said Trump's economic proposals wouldn't work. Trump accused Clinton of being all talk and no action. The election is November 8th. Polls show it a close race to succeed President Obama, who's constitutionally barred from beyond two terms. Gabonese President Ali Bongo scheduled to be inaugurated for another seven-year term in office Tuesday, 3 days after the controversial and narrowly won election was validated by the country's highest court, despite a challenge from opposition candidate Jean Ping. Martha, an unemployed mother, said economic conditions in the oil-rich nation remain poor. She said she has a big family and no means to support them. International observers criticized the August 27 ballot as lacking transparency. Taiwan bracing for another blow from another typhoon Tuesday, this time one named Meggy. This is VOA News. The embattled Syrian city of Aleppo sustained more airstrikes Monday, killing dozens in the rebel-held eastern sector. Medical supplies are said to be running low. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
What we have seen from the Assad regime and the Russians is a concerted campaign to strike civilian targets, to bomb civilians into submission.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, meanwhile, said the government of President Bashar al-Assad and its Russian allies seem intent on taking Aleppo and destroying it in the process. He also discounted a report that the Assad government is preparing to take action in a unity coalition. Syria's Foreign Minister Walid Al-Mualim, in an interview on Lebanese television, took aim at the U.S. and rebels for failing to abide by a U.S.-Russian ceasefire announced earlier this month that collapsed. Monitors from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights say nearly 250 people have been killed in the city and outlying areas since a shaky ceasefire disintegrated days ago. The U.S. Monday issued a criminal charge and economic sanctions against the Chinese company Dandong Hongsheng Industrial Developmental Company for its alleged support of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Its chairwoman and three top executives were also charged with conspiring to evade sanctions against North Korea. Mark Toner is a U.S. spokesman.
It was necessary to take these actions to maintain the integrity of the sanctions that were imposed by the United Nations and by the United States. And the United States and the international community will not stand idly by while North Korea continues to flout its international obligations, as outlined in numerous UN Security Council resolutions.
The company is also under investigation by Chinese authorities for its alleged connection with a North Korean bank suspected of financing Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter Monday said more than $100 billion is needed to upgrade the country's nuclear force, including the construction of a new generation of weapons. Speaking at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota Monday, Carter said the credibility of the American nuclear arsenal is crucial to ensuring its deterrent power. Violent crime increased nearly 4% in the U.S. last year, although the number of offenses remains below the peaks of the 1990s. The Federal Bureau of Investigation said after a two-year decline, it's been seen a spike in murders and other violent crimes, including rape, aggravated assault, and robbery. Canada has confirmed that it found the wreckage of the second of two British ships lost in an Arctic expedition back in the 1840s. Sir John Franklin and his 128-member crew aboard the HMS Terror and Erebus perished after their vessels struck ice during the search for the elusive Northwest Passage linking the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The two candidates in this year's U.S. presidential election held their first debate on Monday evening.
Race remains a significant challenge in our country. Unfortunately, race still determines too much, often determines where people live, determines what kind of education in their public schools they can get, and yes, it determines how they're treated in the criminal justice system.
That's former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the first woman to lead a major U.S. political party. She squared off last night with Republican Donald Trump. New fighting has been reported in South Sudan's Bentiu town between forces loyal to Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir, and the U.S. expresses concerns about Ethiopia's record on human rights and democracy.
Ethiopia has had some great success in dealing with improving job opportunities and education for Ethiopians, but we remain concerned about the level of human rights.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. South African universities are closed amid violent tuition protests, and diaspora Africans are dismayed by FIFA's decision to eliminate its anti-racism task force. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The two candidates in this year's U.S. presidential election, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton of the Democratic Party and businessman Donald Trump of the Republican Party, held their first nationally televised debate last night. Among the topics covered was the issue of race relations in the United States. First, Hillary Clinton.
Race remains a significant challenge in our country. Unfortunately, race still determines too much. Often determines where people live, determines what kind of education in their public schools they can get, and yes, it determines how they're treated in the criminal justice system. We've just seen those two tragic examples in both Tulsa and Charlotte. And we've got to do several things at the same time. We have to restore trust between communities and the police. We have to work to make sure that our police are using the best training, the best techniques, that they're well prepared to use force only when necessary. Everyone should be respected by the law, and everyone should respect the law. Right now, that's not the case in a lot of our neighborhoods. So I have, ever since the first day of my campaign, called for criminal justice reform.
For his part, Donald Trump said if elected president, he will restore law and order in the United States.
Well, first of all, Secretary Clinton doesn't want to use a couple of words, and that's law and order. And we need law and order. If we don't have it, we're not going to have a country. And when I look at what's going on in Charlotte, a city I love, a city where I have investments, when I look at what's going on throughout various parts of our country, whether it's, I mean, I can just keep naming them all day long. We need law and order in our country. And I just got today the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police. We just came in. We have endorsements from, I think, almost every police group, a large percentage of them in the United States. We have a situation where we have our inner cities, African-Americans, Hispanics, are living in hell because it's so dangerous. You walk down the street, you get shot. In Chicago, they've had thousands of shootings, thousands, since January 1st. Thousands of shootings.
The two candidates also discussed Donald Trump's decision not to release his federal income tax. First, Mr. Trump.
I don't mind releasing. I'm under a routine audit, and it'll be released. And as soon as the audit's finished, it'll be released. But you will learn more about Donald Trump by going down to the federal elections, where I filed a 104-page, essentially financial statement of sorts, the forms that they have. It shows income. In fact, the income, I just looked today, the income is filed at $694 million for this past year. $694 million. If you would have told me I was going to make that 15 or 20 years ago, I would have been very surprised. But that's the kind of thinking that our country needs. When we have a country that's doing so badly, that's being ripped off by every single country in the world, it's the kind of thinking that our country needs. I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes when she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted.
Secretary Clinton said Trump has refused to release his taxes because he probably has not paid any taxes at all.
For 40 years, everyone running for president has released their tax returns. You can go and see nearly, I think, 39, 40 years of our tax returns, but everyone has done it. We know the IRS has made clear there is no prohibition on releasing it when you're under audit. So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Second, maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. Third, we don't know all of his business dealings, but we have been told through investigative reporting that he owes about $650 million to Wall Street and foreign banks. Or maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. You know, I made a mistake using a private email, and if I had to do it over again, I would obviously do it differently. But I'm not going to make any excuses. It was a mistake, and I take responsibility for that.
That's former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. You also heard Republican Donald Trump in their first nationally televised debate on Monday evening. Whoever wins this election, it seems it will have a global impact. Joining us from Kampala, Uganda, is journalist Alex Atuhir, news editor of the Uganda Daily Monitor. Good morning to you, Alex.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here on Daybreak Africa. Did you watch the debate?
Yes, I did, and very interesting debate. And I think it was very well watched across the continent.
So, Alex, do you think other Africans have been following the U.S. presidential race? And if so, is it just a sheer curiosity or they are concerned?
Well, obviously, one of the biggest stories at this time, so the presidential election in the U.S. has been followed, both here in Uganda, in East Africa, and across the continent. And I think, yes, very many across Africa would be interested in who the candidate's agendas and which candidate would be coming in as the next U.S. president, because it has a bearing on the U.S. policies towards Africa in terms of funding and in terms of the U.S. funding, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. So, but the debate and the election seems to have been dominated by the internal issues, especially in the U.S. economy. So it's obviously a very big concern, the election in the U.S., for very many people across Africa.
Yes, Alex, and sometime in the process, the issue of terrorism is being discussed. Africa is in the midst of this fight against terrorism. How much impact do you think whoever wins would this have on the fight against terrorism in Africa?
Well, terrorism remains a world threat, and it's not only an American agenda. And we have had attacks here in Uganda and in East Africa, in Kenya, not so long ago. So that's an area of a major cooperation, of irrespective of who wins the next U.S. presidency. And we expect that whatever next administration comes in, the bilateral cooperation on terrorism support will continue to come in.
So, Alex, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, is this also playing in the social media in Africa?
Very much so.
Alex.
Very much so. There are very, very interesting comments coming through on Twitter and Facebook and online. People following the debate, people are rating the candidates, and quite obvious today. I think Clinton has had a very good day today.
Alex, we thank you very much again for joining us on Daybreak Africa. Thank you, Alex.
You are welcome.
Journalist Alex Atu here is the news editor of the Uganda Daily Monitor. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 27th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The United States has promised to provide $3 billion to assist refugees and migrants globally. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield told viewers Henok Fente that creating economic opportunities in the Horn and other regions of Africa is a strategy that has been agreed upon in the Leaders' Summit of the U.N. General Assembly.
Ethiopia has had some great success in dealing with improving job opportunities and education for Ethiopians, but we remain concerned about the level of human rights and concerns about the ability of individuals to express themselves. And I think if the government opened up in that area, we'll see Ethiopia thrive and people will continue to contribute to that country's growth. In terms of our relations with Eritrea, we do not have a development program in Eritrea. We have an embassy there. We do a lot of public diplomacy work, but we're not doing any development assistance or other assistance in Eritrea.
And Somalia?
Somalia, we have a big program. We are not only supporting development programs where we can do development programs, but we are supporting governance. We're supporting the government of Somalia rebuilding this government so that people have confidence. I'm very proud that we have the first ambassador in 20 years, Ambassador Schwartz, started a few months ago, and he has been working closely with the Somalia government, but also with other partners to bring Somalia back into the community of nations. And we're hopeful that in the next few weeks, Somalia will have an electoral process that people will have confidence in, and that will help them in terms of addressing the insecurity that Al-Shabaab is engaged in and help the AMISOM troop contributing countries work to improve security in this country so that they can develop. With insecurity, development cannot take place. Businesses are very conscious they're going to vote for political stability before economic benefits.
And there has been street demonstrations, particularly with young people in Ethiopia in the two main regions, Amhara and Oromia. What is the U.S. position on that?
We're very worried about these. We've had very intense discussions with the government of Ethiopia at the highest levels. We have encouraged the government to address the concerns there and look for ways to provide opportunities for these young people to express their dissatisfaction.
Now, we've covered today there were demonstrators outside, and you know, you hear them probably in Washington, D.C.
from
your office.
Thousands of them demonstrate. And I think the reason we have these major demonstrations in the United States and in Europe is because people don't have an outlet inside of Ethiopia. And so they have an outlet in the United States.
Aside from having a democratic exercise, they're actually criticizing the U.S. And I'm sure you've heard this in Congress also. Chris Smith is not happy with what's going on, Congressman Chris Smith in Ethiopia. He has a bill that he proposed just a couple of weeks ago. They're talking about a double standard here. Do you think that they have a point, these demonstrators and some of your lawmakers?
They don't have a point. We don't have a double standard. And it's important that people understand that we walk a fine line for policy. We walk the line between trying to work with countries to help them address their concerns and help people address their concerns. If we were not talking to the Ethiopian government about civil rights, about human rights, about press freedoms, who else would be doing it?
Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She was speaking with Henok Fente of VOA's Horn of Africa service. Unrest over the cost of university education has escalated in South Africa, prompting several institutions to temporarily close. The Fees Must Fall movement started last year and triggered a vow from the president that university tuition would not rise in 2016, but proposed 2017 fee hikes have reawakened the movement. VOA's Anita Powell visited campuses in Johannesburg to see what students are saying.
On Monday, protesting students barged into classes at the University of Johannesburg, prompting many lecturers to cancel class. Natsikle Loselo, a 21-year-old accounting student, says she's mad at the protesters.
There's someone who's about to finish their degree now, and then this strike affects them, they fail, or something happens, they can't write exams, they have to repeat the modules next year.
But student protests have spread, and at least four universities have temporarily closed since the government last week proposed tuition hikes of up to 8%. Several large schools have reported vandalism against university property and scuffles between security staff and protesters. The University of the Witwatersrand reported that authorities found petrol bombs on campus over the weekend, tweeting a photo of what looked like homemade Molotov cocktails. Students inside the movement say they won't let up until their demands are met. Jafta Kolisang, a 28-year-old history master's student, has been lurking outside the gates of the University of the Witwatersrand ever since he was suspended in June for participating in protests.
No, I don't regret it. I'm doing it for black students. Yes, myself, I've been in similar situations. When I completed my matric, I couldn't go study because I didn't have money. So we can't have that cycle of, that is violence itself.
His friend Josh Nell, who is white, is majoring in political philosophy. He says he thinks the government should tax the super wealthy to fund tuition.
This is a long overdue movement aimed at challenging the very economic foundations that continue to justify and perpetuate the super exploitation of black labor by white capital.
The head of the University of the Witwatersrand, Vice Chancellor Adam Habib, told VOA while he sympathizes with the call for free education, South Africa's government doesn't have the means or the infrastructure to pull off such a feat. Habib, a political scientist, offered a theory about why this is happening now.
I think we are reflecting the broader polarization in the society, which itself is a product of inequality.
His university will vote later in the week whether to close temporarily, as the issue continues to rage throughout South Africa. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In South Sudan, a military spokesman of the SPLA-M faction, allied to former First Vice President Riek Machar, says opposition and government forces fought in Rupkodna County on Sunday. Things were calm on Monday, but hundreds of civilians reportedly have fled Bentiu town and are seeking shelter at a United Nations camp. Bonifacio Taban has more from Kampala.
Army opposition spokesman Major Weriel Pogba Luang said government and rebel force exchanged heavy gunfire in Wichbar, Tong, and the Fakur areas northwest of Bentiu on Sunday. Government force now control both Bentiu and Rupkodna town in the oil-rich former Unity State. Pog accused government force of starting the fighting. He said government force have been hunting for rebel fighters for the past week in area just outside of Bentiu and Rupkodna, which are controlled by the armed opposition. Pog said rebel force refueled the attacks about 8 kilometers outside of the town.
Our defensive locations at Pakur, Wijbar, Tong, and Kaljak areas came under substantial assaults from the regime's army. However, our courageous SPLA-IO army badly defeated the attackers back to Bentiu town.
Pog did not specify how many casualties result from the attacks and counter-attacks. Pog accused force loyal to President Salva Kiir of resorting to war despite permanent ceasefire declared by both President Kiir and Machar after deadly fighting broke out in Juba in July.
We are not attacking the government. The government have attacked our positions. We don't attack them. They are the ones who came with aim of gaining more territories and pursuing us.
South Sudan Army spokesman Brigadier General Rurai Kong said he has no knowledge of fighting in that area. Pog said the SPLA-IO has no choice but to fight the South Sudan Army in self-defense.
We have no other alternative than to fight. We fight the genocidal government, the government that subjected our civilian into untold suffering and death. Our people are living in bushes. Our people are living in armies camps across the country for almost 3 years. How do you term such organizations? It is the only fighting that will let the government in Juba go away from the civilians.
The armed opposition ally to Machar said the 2015 peace deal has collapsed and the transitional government of national unity is no longer abiding by President Kiir's decision to replace Machar with his former chief negotiator, Taban Dengai. For BOA News, I'm Bonifacio Taban in Kampala.
Anti-hate groups such as Kick It Out expressed surprise at FIFA's announcement this week to eliminate its anti-racism task force. The international governing body of football said the task force had completed its mission, but Kick It Out's professional players' engagement manager, Paul Montemayor, tells Ricky Schreier that there is still a lot of work to be done when it comes to exposing racism, especially against players of African descent in Europe.
In listening to what they say, it's almost like their job has been done, which is something they've said. And for us, who recognise that there's still a lot of work to be done around racism within in Europe, it's somewhat perplexing.
Can you give me examples of why this task force should still be around, incidents of racism?
We've had issues in certain aspects, in certain parts of Europe, like Russia, where black players have been openly racially abused. And not enough has really been done about it. Those issues have been happening for, you know, the last couple of years, to be honest. You know, there have been, you know, parts of Italy and places where there have been issues around discriminatory racist behaviour. There's been aspects of anti-Semitism. Those are this type of behaviour that's unacceptable, that really, for us, highlights there is still a lot of work to be done. You know, we cannot give ourselves a pat on the back in Europe or even around the world, because there is so much more work that needs to be done to combat this kind of behavior.
Now, last year, FIFA introduced an anti-discrimination monitoring system. Is that still in place, and how does that work?
Well, from what I gather, it was to monitor issues and situations that may happen at games, which is a difficult thing to do because there are so many games played in Europe. Monitoring every single one at the same time is a very difficult thing to do. But from what I gather, that's what it was about. It was about monitoring games, especially, I suppose, flashpoint games, you know, where there could be situations that could arise. It's often those games that situations don't arise. You know, there's lots of games played throughout Europe during the year that are not monitored, where issues arise. And it's not the fact that the issues are arising, because that's going to happen. It's what we do, it's what we put into place to highlight and expose the behaviour, and then to educate people to understand the impact that their behaviour can have on those affected by it.
What would your organisation like to see happen in the long run? Because as your organisation said, there is still racism that occurs at these events sometimes.
Well, our role and the role of other anti-discrimination and racist organisations around Europe and around the world is to highlight to FIFA that these situations are still happening, that they are still occurring, and to challenge FIFA in what they're going to do about it. You know, it's clear, you know, all organisations are actively campaigning against racism and discrimination. And it's disappointing and disheartening to hear that kind of news. But it's up to us in football to lead the way in projecting, I suppose you could call, an inclusive nature for the world. I mean, there's no doubt football has the power to unite people from all different backgrounds. And it is important to recognise that there is good work being done to promote equality across football, but also to understand and to acknowledge and to accept that there is a lot more work to be done.
That was Paul Mortimer, professional players engagement manager for Kick It Out. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with Arthur Opio Oloya about his book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgency. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kHz and 15580 kHz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.